Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, a show serving the greater bleeding disorders community, brought to you by Believe Limited and Bloodstream Media, and made possible thanks to our presenting sponsor, Takeda. I'm your presenting sponsor, what? I'm your patient, advocate, and host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm shocked. I love that. I hope it stays in.
That's a first.
I am your healthcare advocate and nonprofit nerd and your other host, as well as your presenting sponsor, Amy Borg. Reminding you to please speak with a healthcare professional before making any treatment decision.
What a ridiculous thing to say. Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, we're not re-recording it, so here we go. On today's show, we got some cool stuff to bring to you. We have some highlights from the American Society of Hematology's end of 2023 meeting. You've heard him here before. Dr. Akshat Jain has returned with a few priorities for the greater bleeding disorders space anyway, coming out of ASH 2023. We also have the latest installment of our gene therapy segment, this time differentiating between the currently available hemophilia A and hemophilia B gene therapies. Some really important distinguishing characteristics there. And lastly, our latest elite athletes segment is featuring community legend Perry Parker. All right, we got all that and more on today's episode. Welcome to Bloodstream.
Hey, listeners, thank you for joining us today. As always, if you like what you hear, please subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast. You can do that on your podcast player, or you can do it online. You can do it on social. You can do it wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Yeah, we're not going to control everything. And we also want you to know, dear listeners, that the Bloodstream Podcast is indeed made possible by our actual presenting sponsor, Takeda.
Right.
Yes,
right.
That's right, Takeda. Takeda's got the website, bleedingdisorders.com. That's where you can learn all about Takeda's resources for and Takeda's commitment to the bleeding disorders community. Our presenting sponsor, Takeda, believes in a world free of bleeds. Amy Bord, were you aware of that? Oh, you are?
I have been aware of that in the past, yes.
And they're dedicated more than even in the last episode to offer a wide range of programs and support to help patients throughout their treatment journey. Wherever on that journey you may be, and you can learn more by simply visiting bleedingdisorders.com. One more time, that's bleedingdisorders.com. And for their founding and ongoing support of the Bloodstream Podcast as its presenting sponsor, and then I'm going to let this go, I would just like to say thanks, Takeda.
Thank you, Takeda.
And thank you to segment sponsor CSL Behring for supporting our gene therapy segment. Amy Bord.
Happy March, happy Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month.
We made it. We made it. We are in Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. Happy, happy. Thank you. Do you remember the first time that Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month was a date of significance in your calendar life? Like, there was a time in my life, even as a person with hemophilia, I didn't care about it's March Madness, it's college basketball, it's ramping up pro basketball, baseball spring. I guess it was mostly about sports. But do you remember the first time you were like, oh, March, it's Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month?
Well, I think this is, I think it's a new thing, like relatively in the last like decade, you know, esque years, it's like a new thing. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I can't wait for the wrath of people online.
Mailbag.
It's not a new thing. Mailbag.
No, you're right. You're right. You're right. We covered it.
No, it's like, yeah, it's like a new to do. And it was the policy team back in the day. I remember there being like a big to do that it was
It was
red tie. It was red tie awareness thing. And it was Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month.
That's right. Because so once upon a time, former President Ronald Reagan referred to the month of March as Hemophilia Awareness Month, but did so in kind of a casual way. It wasn't an actual like Health and Human Services health calendar date of interest, but it kind of then became this casual thing until, you're right, during Val's tenure as the CEO, president of NHF, now NBDF, there was a big movement to not only formalize the recognition in the HHS calendar, but to do so in the inclusive way of recognizing it as Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. So you're 100% correct. It is relatively new. And that is now, you know, gives us this bedrock to sort of proudly celebrate You know, yeah. So sometimes I go, who cares about these dates of interest in the calendar, right? Like sometimes it can feel a little like, what does that actually mean that today's March 8th? No, it matters because it creates the bedrock for opportunity to raise awareness, amplify stories from the community, and try to drive more interest into drug discovery and research to benefit us. So happy Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month.
And how our media works, like how our media works nowadays, it's nice to have a hook, to have like a piece of information. So having these like awareness days, having World Hemophilia Day, these types of things are really lovely as a little hook that you can, you know, amplify your message. So we had Rare Disease Day, you know.
Yes, we did. Happy zebras.
Now it was like a week ago or something. But anyway, like those days are really important. So anyway, happy Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. Also, this episode is going live on Friday, March 8th. And so Washington Day is like our Hill Day happened yesterday.
Hey,
it's not that now. So we have no updates. Hope it didn't. Hope they didn't blow it.
You and me both. And we'll find out when the new NBDF CEO, Phil Gattone, hopefully joins us in the not too distant future, right? Huh?
Hope y'all didn't blow it.
Before we start moving through our segments and hear from Dr. Jane and so forth, Amy, I have to say that I think there's a chance that today will be a day I forever look back on as a turning point, top five most important day of my professional life.
Wait.
What?
Why?
That
I can't believe, just listeners, this was not on the list. You know, we have bullets.
Yeah, you know. Going rogue with Amy Board. It's
okay.
I learned from the best, Amy. There's a bunch of stuff that today is coming together and clicking along and falling into place on a couple of fronts. And some of it's relatively new and exciting. Some of it has been with me for a very long time. Mm. And it seems as though, in real time as we're recording this, today is a day that I am going to be like, wow, that was the before after. Now, annoyingly, I really can't say more than that. So this is just a very obnoxious, teasy way of being honest and letting you in. I'm currently quite excited. And the one little hint I will give, kind of already gave it for those who are really keyed in, is one of these projects has been with me a very long time. You've been hearing about it here on the Bloodstream podcast for a very long time. Mm. And the world might hear about it before the year is up. So to come in the not too distant future. And I hope you will excuse the vagaries for now.
Oh, man. Listeners, I say you guys should turn your wrath on PJL for giving us this tease. Like, take all of the wrath you probably had to me and now fling it over to Patrick's side.
That'll encourage more sharing in the future. That's a great idea. Good call.
Well, we're waiting with bated breath. We cannot wait, good sir.
It will be good for our community. I can say that as well. So more to come,
cool.
Fingers crossed, put good juju in the air. And with that, Amy Board, tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear from Dr. Jane in just a couple of moments.
Well, as most of our listeners know, ASH is an annual conference for all the hematologists of the world. It is a global conference. Every single person who is involved in hematology descends on the town.
Because you were there.
40,000.
40,000.
40,000 hematologists. It's crazy. The first The first ASH I went to was in New Orleans, and one of our Uber drivers was like, are y'all with like those blood doctor things? Like they are taking over everything. I couldn't believe it. Like the Uber driver like knew. But anyway, it is a massive clinical conference. It is just like kind of a a pin in the calendar of everyone's calendar in terms of like data that's going to be presented, research that's being presented, ideas and networking and those types of things. So Dr. Jane is a huge friend of the podcast. He actually stopped by. We were there. Bloodstream was there. We were there with our science fair. And so he very lovingly asked if he could come on and give us some updates about what came out of ASH, in particular with bleeding disorders. And he has fantastic bullets, if you will, of some really interesting things, some new ways of thinking about therapies, women and undiagnosed folks in general. And so anyway, I had a great conversation with Dr. Jane as always. Listeners, I am back with Dr. Jane. Yay! Welcome back to the podcast. How are you, good sir?
Thank you very much, Amy. So happy to see you. Albeit we did meet not very long ago at ASH, and that was an amazing meeting.
It was an amazing meeting, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Tell me a little bit about ASH, maybe for our listeners who don't know what the conference is. What do you all do, and why is it important for you all as hematologists?
Absolutely. American Society of Hematology hosts an annual conference that features all the top research, clinical developments, and brings together the think tank, if you may, of everything hematology under one roof. I think it's one of the biggest draws for all hematologists, not just in North America, but all around the world. And this time in December of 2023, we had it fortunately in our backyard in San Diego in Southern California with an audience of upwards of 40,000 people attending the meeting, which, as you can imagine, people invested in and presenting their research, showcasing products around hematology, all under one roof. It was an amazing scientific discourse, as something that we all, as hematologists, just absolutely love and adore to attend and participate. So it's an annual event, more of a fair than a meeting, a research meeting. But we have another one coming up in December of 2024. And fortunately, this time again, being repeated at the venue in San Diego. So we learned a lot. We presented a lot. And we did a lot of work around hematology at ASH 2023 in San Diego.
So tell the listeners a little bit about what some of your takeaways were in terms of bleeding disorder research. What was some of the discourse? What were some of the things that were presented that was interesting to you in terms of hemophilia and von Willebrand's disease?
Absolutely. I mean, this meeting was such an eye-opener because we all, as clinical scientists and clinical practitioners in our little niche and in our little corners in the country and around the world, to help and work around advancement for the field. But at ASH 2023, breaking perspectives all under one roof was something that we really take advantage of. So starting with one of a very unique presentation at ASH, or American Society of Hematology meeting, was work that has been done around bleeding disorders. So when we say our bleeding disorder community, when we talk about classic hematology blood disorders, we do talk about hemophilia, we talk about von Willebrand disease, but there was a lot of focus this time around on disorders that are of vascular origin, that tend to be under-recognized. So all of those patients that we see in our clinic and around the world with chronic, for example, mucosal bleeding such as nosebleeds, these patients with severe epistaxis, these patients with severe mucosal gum bleeding. And when we do workup and we find that, hey, they're negative for von Willebrand disease, they are negative for workup for hemophilia A, B, or hemophilia C, and other coagulation factor deficiencies, having them put under a bucket of some of the other bleeding disorders was something that was presented. A study that had featured in utilization of some novel therapies in treating patients with these inherited bleeding disorders in adults showed significant improvement, specifically presenting as chronic, recurrent, refractory, be they regular and not responding to regular therapy, epistaxis was something that really caught my eye and certainly I brought it home to my colleagues and helped educate some of our providers at home to say, hey, don't call it, let's not say that the patient may not have a bleeding disorder, but let's keep looking because there are more than one prevalent diagnoses that could lead to the bleeding disorder. Some of the work that we presented, which was around hemophilia, was looking at outcomes in blood disorders for people who are on emicizumab. Now, we know that emicizumab has found its rightful place in treatment for hemophilia, but how does that impact the hemoglobin? How does that impact anemia? Those secondary outcomes that people with hemophilia suffer from. And some of the work that we had done showed that there was significant improvement from baseline. Some of the people didn't have anemia to begin with, but we know people with severe hemophilia do develop microbleeding, do have chronic blood loss. And an unintended but welcome, unintended but welcome consequence of the bleeding of emicizumab was an improved hemoglobin and better iron metrics, to which we got statistically significant values demonstrating that maybe an additional advantage of non-factor therapies is better bleed control, thereby less iron loss, and maybe better anemias. Now, that is more relevant for some of our carriers of hemophilia, women with hemophilia who are otherwise on not prophylaxis therapy, but certainly makes a case of having some of the focus when we are treating people with hemophilia to be on other comorbidities as well. Try to demonstrate that there is a role in looking at anemias. There is a role at looking at iron status, looking at quality of life, and certainly everything that comes as iron deficiency anemia or anemia gets worse in people with chronic bleeding disorders. So it was our first attempt to look at some off-target effects of emicizumab or Hemlibra, which are positive and welcome and something that certainly needs to be done in a bigger cohort and internationally, not just the United States. So certainly that was something that we were really happy that it was shared, and there was a lot of discourse around it.
What about drug development? Thinking about bleeding disorder drug development, what are some of the things that were coming out of some of the research? Pipeline discussions, research and studies. Tell us about the products.
Yeah, so this meeting was very special because a lot of discussion focused around, again, we are sticking to classic hematology disorder, not blood cancers, for the sake of our audience here and the discussion today. But this meeting was remarkable with studies that had demonstrated work around gene therapy, not just for bleeding disorders, for hemophilia A and hemophilia B, which certainly were presented. You know, me and Dr. Steve Pipe presented the extended data on the factor IX Padua variant version of gene therapy. And we now know that those initial patients who were the first few recipients of Hemgenix or our factor IX gene therapy continue to have a sustained factor IX expression, which is very welcome. We learned a lot around nuances of gene therapy in terms of liver irritation and transaminitis. We certainly learned a lot more about the newer factor VIII gene therapies that are going to hit the market once the phase 3 data is approved and presented, and was presented. It is interesting to see that we are evolving and refining what has now been set as a benchmark for hemophilia gene therapies, both for A and hemophilia B. So certainly, drug development-wise, gene therapy stole the show for classic hematology disorders, specifically around sickle cell disease, a disease that has been neglected for far too long, finally found its place with plenary sessions, which is like this big, almost a red carpet, Oscar-like attention that was the center feature and literally the centerpiece of the meeting to talk about outcomes of gene therapy. One of my mentors, Dr. Banu Wijgen, presented the work that their group had done around global access to care with sickle cell disease, with their result in Africa being presented as a plenary session, which is a big deal. For it to be selected for a plenary session and to see how the outcomes are faring for these children suffering from severe sickle cell disease in Africa and how it compares to what we are doing in the United States was an absolute motivation and another high point of the meeting in December. Mm. Now, just to go back, Amy, the disorder, I think I mentioned the significant work on that bleeding disorder, which commonly gets under-recognized, but we didn't talk about the disease. So it's hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, HHT, is an under-recognized disease. And fascinating data demonstrated that after von Willebrand disease, it's the second most prevalent cause of inherited bleeding disorder. And we don't talk about it often. We certainly don't screen for it, despite the fact that there are excellent screening tests and clinical tools, scoring systems that are available and have been standardized over decades now that we should be paying more attention to. And with some of the drug developments demonstrating clinical benefit in these HHT patients, I think we can certainly utilize that into our clinical practice. So I just got reminded of it because hemorrhagic hereditary telangiectasia HHT is something that we absolutely need to talk more about. We can detect better. And we even have a genome sequencing panel that can be sent commercially for these patients. So it's not like a rare genetic test that only maybe 7 labs around the world do it, but it's a commercially available test for certain genetic mutations. And I think the incidence of HHT is around 1 in 3,000. We know the incidence of von Willebrand disease is about 1 in 150 or 1 in 110 humans, at least in North America. But HHT was, I think, 1 in 2,000 to 3,000. And we know for hemophilia A is 1 in 10,000. So that puts it right in the middle, right after von Willebrand disease is the second most hereditary disorder that we don't talk about as much. So I think that was a major takeaway from that meeting.
I want to thank you for being on the podcast today and giving us an update. Final question, I guess, what was your biggest provocative takeaway? What is something that is a question that's still kind of marinating in your mind? What was your biggest question coming out of the meeting?
I think more than a question, I think it was a challenge. Very fortunate to be involved in our training seminars or trainee seminars. So we do a lot of education for our next generation hematologists. And what I saw in the next generation trainees as part of our trainee program and educational curriculum and program was a lot of excitement about what's happening around the world for hematology with gene therapy and novel therapies like antithrombin and TFPI inhibitors and Serpin FC, and et cetera. But at the same time, there is a discrepancy in pediatric trainees and adult hematology trainees. While there is a lot of support around training for classic hematology in the adult hematology oncology training programs, with our pediatric trainees or people who have pediatric background who want to be a pediatric hematologist, I think we do need to work and motivate these folks a little better, support them a little better, so that groundbreaking research can be initiated. And it's these new upcoming crop of hematologists which will probably bring on the next gene therapy or the next breakthrough to treat these disorders where we can finally say, hey, we have now found the holy grail. We have now found the cure for hemophilia. So I think it motivated me to gear up and create more funding opportunities and bring in more accessible training opportunities and bring in equity to training our next generation of hematologists. And this meeting was a perfect avenue to engage leaders, funders, and certainly our pharmaceutical industry support members to help gain our trainees significantly more and with equal equity. That really was really powerful for us.
That sounds wonderful. That's kudos to you, good sir. Thank you for being on the podcast again and offering an update from ASH. And we'll definitely have you on at another time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amy. Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
We'll be back.
Gene therapy for hemophilia A and B is now commercially available in the United States and beyond. However, there are some important distinguishing characteristics between the currently available treatment options for each of hemophilia A and B. What are those distinguishing characteristics and what do they mean? We talked to Dr. Mark Redding about just that right now on our gene therapy segment.
The following segment is intended for informational and educational purposes only and was written and developed by Bloodstream Media.
There is obviously a difference between the hemophilia A gene therapy product and the hemophilia B gene therapy product in data, efficacy, all of those words that we use. Tell me why. Why is there such a difference? Why are we seeing different outcomes?
Super good question. there's a lot to talk about, but I think, you know, the biggest difference so far in the currently available gene therapies that we have and the things that are currently being studied in the sort of late phase clinical trials, the biggest difference between hemophilia A and hemophilia B gene therapy seems to be durability. In other words, how long do the factor levels stay up? So for factor 9, hemophilia B gene therapy, it seems that whatever response you get, it seems to be stable over time, at least out to 3 years or so. With the hemophilia A gene therapy, what we're seeing is the factor levels tend to fall off over time. They don't seem quite as stable. That's right now the major difference between the two. The reasons for that are still not completely understood. We talk a lot about part of this probably being related to the fact that the way we're currently doing gene therapy for hemophilia A and B is we're introducing the corrected copy of the gene into a cell called hepatocyte. It's a liver cell. The hepatocyte is where factor 9 is normally made, but it's not the cell that normally makes factor 8. So although other cells can make proteins, cells that aren't the cell that normally makes a protein can be given the instructions to make a protein. When you ask a cell that doesn't normally make factor 8 to do so, it may not be as easy as just telling the cell to do it and giving it the tools. So there's some speculation that part of the problem between factor 8 and factor 9, or part of the difference, is that we're asking the cell that normally makes factor 9 to make it, and that goes okay. But we're asking a cell that doesn't normally make factor 8 to produce it, and it may not be quite as easy as we thought it would be. So there are probably other reasons as well, but that right now seems to be where a lot of the discussion is centered. We need to figure that out. I mean, why it seems to work differently for factor 8 and factor 9 is a really important question. That's something that has to get sorted out to take this forward.
What's the cell that makes factor 8?
So factor 8 is normally made in, it's made in the liver, but it's in a different cell, not the hepatocyte. It's made in a cell called the sinusoidal endothelial cell. So the endothelium is the cells that blind the blood vessels and the sinusoids, which are little vascular spaces in the liver. That's where factor 8's made. So a little bit different place than factor 9 is made. And both the currently available gene therapy treatments deliver the gene therapy to the hepatocyte, so into the organ, but not to the exact same cell type that normally makes factor 8, and that probably has a fair bit to do with why it looks a bit different.
What is the by the way? Can you say that cell name 3 times fast?
No, yes, hepatic sinusoidal endothelial cell. That's a whole mouthful.
I'm so impressed you got that out. You've obviously said it before. But what would it take to get that, to administer into that cell?
Yeah, so the current platform that we're using for gene therapy, we're using something called adeno-associated virus, AAV. This is a form of a virus that's really good at delivering genetic material to a cell We can target these things to certain cell types, and targeting the hepatocytes is relatively straightforward. Targeting other cell types is possible, but a little harder. So I think that's sort of the superficial answer to the question. I don't know that we're going to see this as the end game for gene therapy. I think it's becoming pretty clear that we may need to move past the current AAV platform, and we may be using other targets. We may be using other cell types to deliver gene therapy in the future. So there's a lot of work going on. There are other gene therapy studies going on right now using other cell types as the target. And so we'll see how that works out and how it compares to what we're currently doing. But I think it's pretty safe to assume, you know, what we're doing right now is gene therapy 1.0. We're going to have to make improvements on this platform to get the results that we want. And that might require moving beyond the AAV platform.
Another question, feel free to be candid as much as possible. As a physician, talking with patients in the clinic space, considering their treatment options, what are the questions or the concerns that hemophilia A patients are having versus hemophilia B patients?
Yeah, honestly, I think the concerns are kind of similar between the two patient groups. I don't know that the concerns are all that different. When I talk to my patients, the questions that that we talk most about are, how well is this going to work in me, and how long is it going to last? And for factor eight, obviously the how long it's going to last question is a bit bigger issue. But the first question is, how well is this going to work in me is applicable to both hemophilia A and B. And, one of the challenges with the way we're currently doing gene therapy for hemophilia is that we can't predict how well it's going to work in a given person. The data that we have shows that average factor levels are, you know, whatever they are, and that looks great, but it doesn't matter what average is. It matters what you are as an individual, right? And the range of responses that we see is quite wide. So if you look at all the data for all the different gene therapy programs that are available and being studied, they all have the same issue in that there's a wide variability in how individual patients respond. So some people get factor levels that are normal, and some people's factor levels never get out of the single digits. And we don't really understand why that is, and we don't know how to predict how a given person is going to respond. So most of our conversations in the clinic with patients who are considering this are centered around those issues and really helping them understand that. Some still want to go forward and do it, and that's great, and we can support that. But you have to understand that piece of it before moving forward.
Once again, this segment has been brought to you by CSL Behring, which now has a first of its kind hemophilia B treatment. Visit beyondhemeb.com or download B Support wherever you get your apps for more information.
Now, some of you listeners may be familiar with Perry Parker and his story, and I'm sure some of you are not. But either way, I expect you're about to learn something and be inspired by a true community legend, especially when we think about athletes with hemophilia. This segment is supported by Sanofi, and Sanofi seeks to expand the idea of what's possible for the hemophilia community. Take a deeper look at the science behind hemophilia and an important connection between factor activity levels and potential activities at levelsmatter.com. And now, on to the segment.
This time on Redefining Impossible, the podcast, we journey to the lush fairways and pristine greens of the golf world. But this isn't just any golfer's tale. This is the story of Perry Parker, a professional golfer from Laguna Niguel, California. Perry's life is a compelling narrative overcoming the challenges of hemophilia A and mastering the art of golf, a testament to his resilience and dedication. Hemophilia severity is determined by factor activity levels, a measurement of how much factor you have in your blood at the time of diagnosis. The more factor you have in your body over time, the better your bleed protection is, which is why many people with hemophilia choose to treat prophylactically. Your doctor can perform measurements to evaluate the factor activity levels in your blood. Learn more about the importance of factor activity levels by talking to your doctor and visiting levelsmatter.com. Imagine the quiet hush of dawn on a golf course, where each fairway is a canvas of meticulous greenery, and every hole tells a story of precision, patience, and persistence. This is a sport that combines the tranquility of nature with the intense focus of the mind. Golf is more than a game. It's a dance of strategy and skill, a solitary battle against the elements and one's own limits. Each stroke is a blend of art and science, a test of both physical ability and mental fortitude. Here, amid the whispering pines and rolling greens, triumphs are not just measured in scores, but in the grace of each swing and the resilience of the spirit. In this world, every player, regardless of their journey, finds a unique path along these manicured paths, a testament to the timeless allure and the challenge of golf. Which brings us to pro golfer Perry Parker. Perry's path in golf began in the most unassuming way, playing with his grandmother on a public course.
I grew up in an athletic family. My dad was a coach and he played sports in college, so sports were important to our family. Obviously, I was the oldest, and with hemophilia, there was a lot of uncertainty on what was going to happen, where I was going to, what sports I could do. I tried a bunch of different sports, but I really got into golf playing with my grandmother once a week on a 9-hole public golf course. I started playing with her and we just had a great time and I really enjoyed the game.
His voice carries the warmth of these treasured memories, a simple beginning to what would become a lifelong passion and profession. But Perry's journey has been far from a leisurely stroll on the greens. Living with hemophilia A, he faced uncertainties and challenges that would deter many.
I have a very strict regimen, a routine of exercise. So I've done this my entire life, and I think that's really been the key for me to being successful. My dad was a coach. I knew that I had a number of severe bad bleeds when I was a kid where my arm got stuck and I had to go to physical therapy to work it out, you know, all those kinds of things. So I knew the severity of the bleeding disorder was going to affect my career as an athlete. We tried to stretch as much as I can. So I stretch an hour a day every day. So I have a stretching routine that I do every day. I have some of those stretches on my YouTube channel at Perry Parker Golf that people could check out. I also do weights, light weights. So I try to do light weights where I have a physical exercise routine where I try to keep my core strength, my upper body strength, and my leg strength up. So I do that. Don't really do a lot of heavy weights, but a lot of repetition, light weights, 5 to 6 pound weights. I work out with a medicine ball. That has been a huge thing for me, is work out with that medicine ball. And then I try to feel like I travel with a jump rope. So I know a lot of people in the bleeding disorder can't do a jump rope, but for me, it's been a great thing.
This discipline and dedication to maintaining his physical fitness is not just about staying in shape. It's about managing his condition and ensuring his longevity in the sport. Perry's story is more about his achievement on the golf course. It's about inspiring others within the hemophilia community.
For 23 years, I've been a motivational speaker in the community. So I always try to go out, tell my story, tell me what I've been through as a person with bleeding disorder, how the ups and downs of having bleeding disorder have affected me as a person and as an athlete, how I've been able to handle my bleed. So speaking in the community is really one of the major things. And then also I'm involved in the Getting in the Game program that I do. And we go out and we do clinics for kids. We go out and take them out on the golf course. We play 9 holes sometimes. We also have the Junior National Championship, which is that we run every year. It's a yearly event where we bring kids from every chapter, 2 kids from every chapter, and we take them out on the course and we teach them how to play golf, and then we take them out and they play 9 holes of golf and teach them how to play golf there. And we've developed a lot of kids in the bleeding disorder community that are now golfers, and they're in the PGA program and they play college golf, some of them. So that's been really cool. So it's just about me getting out in the community, telling my story.
It's in these moments, sharing his knowledge and inspiring young golfers, that Perry's impact transcends his own achievements.
You know, most people with a bleeding disorder are resilient and have had to handle adversity. So we grew up knowing how to handle adversity. And golf is a lot like a roller coaster ride. And so is the bleeding disorder. So meaning that you can play great for a while and then your game starts to go down and you play bad and you might play great. And then, so it's kind of like a big roller coaster, and a bleeding disorder is the same, you know, like you feel good for a month and then you might have two bleeds in a row. So you're dealing with a lot of ups and downs.
Harry's story is a powerful reminder that the barriers we face, whether in sports or in life, can become the very fuel for our greatest achievements.
I think golf is the perfect sport for a person with a bleeding disorder for a couple reasons. It's very physically active. If no one's ever played golf or played 18 holes and walked an 18-hole course, it is very physically active. And it's also, so you need to have endurance. So endurance is the key, being able to walk, being able to feel like you can make it through 18 holes, which is usually 4 to 5 hour round.
In Perry Parker, we find a man who not only defied the odds, but reshaped them to his advantage. His story is one of determination, skill, and the power of dreaming big, regardless of the challenges. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Redefining Impossible, the podcast. Don't forget to watch the film Redefining Impossible for free at EliteAthletesWithHemophilia.com. And thanks once again to Sanofi for sponsoring this segment. I'm Keith Korneluk, and I'll talk to you next month on Redefining Impossible, the podcast, only on Bloodstream.
Thank you, Perry Parker. Also, just noted, I can't call you Perry. I can only call you Perry Parker.
That's true.
Like,
yeah.
In conversations, I've had conversations like this whole time, and it's only Perry Parker.
Why would you stop at Perry?
I apologize. Anyway. Legend. Thank you, Perry Parker. Sanofi aims to raise the bar for patients living with hemophilia. Reimagine what's possible by visiting rarebloodisorders.com to hear more about Sanofi's dedication to the bleeding disorder community.
Hear, hear, hear. And thank you to Perry Parker, to Dr. Jane and Dr. Redding, and to everyone who's helped contribute to this episode of the Bloodstream Podcast, which, of course, would not be possible without our presenting sponsor. That is Takeda, the presenting sponsor.
It's Takeda. It isn't
it's
you,
Takeda.
But
it's still not
so close.
Maybe one day I could be the presenting sponsor of a podcast presented by Patrick James Lynn. It's not because I'm hosting it, just because I'm in the background going like, make it. And thanks as well to CSL Behring for their support of the gene therapy segment, a really important segment at this particular period of time. Amy Board, we are going to be back toward the end of Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month, although you will see stuff coming out from Bloodstream Media on social all throughout the month. So if you're active on social media, you will be seeing our stuff, but you won't hear from us again until March 22nd. And what do we have coming up on that episode, Amy?
Jessica Richmond, who is the co-host of the Flow podcast, which you all know on the Bloodstream Media Network, will be joining me. And Anita Berkman, who is the CEO of the Plasma Foundation, who I had a fantastic conversation with, love a lady executive. So we've got good star power on the next episode.
Well, that's cool. I mean, you've hyped me up for it now. So cool.
100%.
And with that, listeners, that is all for this episode. Presenting sponsor Takeda, just again to clarify, be sure to subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast presented by Takeda wherever you listen.
And always, mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com is where always. You can send anything.
Anything Raph, at all. Yeah,
good comments if you have guests. Yeah, tax information if you have some questions, just kind of let us know. Anything, like we're really here for y'all. Okay.
Please, God, don't ask us about your taxes.
You will get the incorrect answer.
I just want
to stress how Patrick and I have degrees in theater. Just want to stress.
It's true. It's just that's true. Oh, all right. And with all of that and more, I am your host and host alone, Patrick James Lynch.
And I am your other host, Amy Board.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.